Now we will hear about strategies for the future by Reverend Ernie Pipes, Minister Emeritus, the UU Community Church of Santa Monica. Reverend Pipes.
It's good to be in Fullerton again. It's been a number of years since I've been in this pulpit. It's well to start on the first Sunday of a new year with a little fable that's often told this time of year. On a cold and windy day, a small snail started up a long journey up the trunk of an ancient cherry tree. And as the little creature traveled patiently upward, a flock of sparrows in an adjacent tree began to laugh at him. One of the sparrows flew over to the cherry tree and landed on a lower branch and said to the snail, "Hold there, little shellback, you're wasting your time. Don't you know there are no cherries in this tree yet?" And the snail did not pause at all in his journey as he turned his head slightly, said in reply, "You are quite right, but there will be cherries by the time I get there." And it's fitting on the first Sunday in 2011 that we ponder both our images, which the fable offers us, and our strategies for the future. The strategies is what I want to talk with you about. Looking back, our images of 2010 are not altogether bright, not economically, not environmentally, and not internationally. More than that, in our personal lives, as our joys and sorrows just told us, there have been mixtures of joy and sadness, pleasure and pain, success and failure, not always in the proportions that we would wish for. We move on, like the little snail, with the expectation that there will be some cherries or their equivalent up ahead. The future, however, doesn't exist in some way like a freeway already there ahead of us, waiting to be moved upon. The future, rather, is unmade in most respects. It's open-ended. It is still yet to be shaped by events which we might creatively participate in. And so with regard to our personal and collective future, I want to suggest that there is much that we can begin in this present to do to give it a desirable shape and content. But there are limitations on what we can do. We are not omnipotent or omniscient. We cannot foresee everything that lies ahead. We are embedded in a context, a setting, a reality, often called a larger scheme of things, over which we have very limited control. Kenneth Boulding, some years ago, made some useful observations about the constraints and limitations that we face as we seek to build and create a personal and collective future. He says there are a variety of givens, a few of which we can know with any certainty. We know for sure about the future of eclipse and the paths of comets. We know that the future will be constrained by the laws of gravity. We know that it will be conforming to the laws of thermodynamics. And of course, these familiar chestnuts, death and taxes, we know are ahead of us. But the larger part of our future will not feature such knowable certainties. What we mainly face are imponderables and uncertainties. And these will have to be dealt with courageously, enabling us by creative strategies to devise some measure of control over our future. And we are not impotent and we're not helpless. Bowling speaks, for example, of the bathtub theorem, namely, that the increase in the stock of anything is equal to the difference between what has been added to it and what has been subtracted from it in a given period. If more water flows into a bathtub than flows out of it in a given period, the amount of water will increase. And if the shape of the tub is constant, the water level will rise. This immutable law applies to melting polar ice caps. It applies to birth and death rates in the human population. It applies to the carrying capacity of planet Earth, to the relationships among income and spending and debt levels for families and nations. These are formal necessities, and they, however, are not unalterable. We can turn off the tap in the bathtub, and we can do lots of things about ending the melting ice caps, the birth rates, and the debt. We are not helpless. There's a corollary to the bathtub theorem. The proposition that nothing can grow for very long without getting too big. And this assumes that in some sense that everything has an optimum size. Whether an insect, a corporation, a population of deer in a given forest, a population of humans on a finite planet, the number of automobiles in a given city. This idea of a scale barrier, a quantity beyond which there is a declining advantage. And the scale barrier can apply to material consumption and acquisition, to the possessions you can find room for in your closets at home. A bumper sticker to catch this insight about planning for the future is the phrase, "Enough is best." And of course, the difficult judgment of how much is enough is quite another calculus. Further, our planning for the future must contend with surprises, with the unforeseen contingencies of our human estate. You and I can make plans for our personal future. We can lay out strategies for vacations, for the purchase of a car or a home, the chance for study, the opening of a new career. But as we move toward the fulfillment of these plans, there can suddenly be radical changes in the whole structure of our life. A malignancy, a job change, an economic recession, the end of a marriage, or the beginning of one, an unplanned pregnancy. A myriad of things can happen and set all our plans awry. The Bible has a phrase that catches this insight. "Watch therefore, ye know neither the day nor the hour." Surprise then is an open possibility, ever present in the elements of the life of a person or a nation or a civilization. And here I think we must take note of a very common flaw in dealing with the uncertainties of the future, a flaw quite common among humans, even to a degree among Unitarian Universalists. Falling back on wishful thinking or magical thinking. As vulnerable human beings, we hunger to feel secure in a world whose very nature is unpredictable change, impermanence, and uncertainty. We hunger for some control over these uncertainties, some source of help, some comfort, some protection, and we prudently purchase insurance policies to soften the blow of an earthquake or a flood or a fire. But it is also a human trait to engage in magical thinking, to appeal to invisible, but we believe, potent forces to protect us. One of the classical textbook's definitions of magical thinking tells us that it is made up of things we do and things we believe in order to make the wished for things come to pass and to keep the terrors at bay. There is an ancient and deep-rooted human proclivity for seeking the intercession of powerful protective forces to cause the wished for things to come to pass, to ward off the dangers to which we otherwise may be susceptible. It is important, I think, to avoid magical thinking. And to keep me alert from magical thinking, I keep on my desk at home an attention-grabbing little card. And on it are these words: change is inevitable, unpredictable, and without conscience. And what this reminds me of is that there is no way to guarantee a desired future. There's no way to guarantee a desired outcome to our plans. No way to be fully protected from the play of chance and change. And yet, this uncertain state is most contrary to our fondest wishes. We would like a little reassuring predictability in our lives, some measure of control over the arbitrariness of events, some assurance that the medium in which we float is not totally indifferent to our hopes. And the great temptation, in one form or another, of magical thinking is that we seek these assurances that there are beliefs and actions that we can embrace that will be efficacious in assuring that we will be treated gently and lovingly by the universe. It's not difficult to be sympathetic with the human yearnings motivating these kinds of belief systems, but I cannot escape the power and the harsh lucidity of the quotation on my desk, a portrait of the universe in which change is inevitable, it is unpredictable, and without conscience. And this last provision seems to me to say that we are embedded in some sort of reality that follows no apparent moral constraints or even moral guidelines. A reality that bestows upon the individual either fortune or misfortune with complete indifference. Worse, these blows seem to be thrust upon us in a random and unpredictable manner with no apparent connection to what is deserved. Good and innocent people die in appalling earthquakes, epidemics, fires, come down with fatal diseases. Good people death and maiming are randomly distributed on the battlefield. When the bullets fly and the shells explode, it's like a throw of the dice as who will be hit and who will be spared. This process doesn't seem to be hostile, just random and indifferent, the universe gratuitously following its own invariable laws, impersonal laws. The poet Stephen Crane wrote the following little dialogue to illustrate this. A man calls out to the universe and says, "I exist." "Well," replied the universe, "that fact has not created in me a sense of obligation. When we were born, there were no contracts, no assurances signed by us and the other party. As the philosopher Sam Keen put it, the inescapable truth about human destiny is that there are imponderable forces at work we didn't put there." And Crane and Keen are reminding us then, as I have sought to do, of the chanciness of life and to be ready for unanticipated surprises. One is reminded also of the familiar saying, tell your plans to the gods and watch them smile. All these features of the human condition must, I think, be courageously kept in mind as we write our New Year's resolutions and lay out our plans on this first Sunday of 2011. So, with all of this unpleasant notification that I have just finished, what we surely want to know are, what then are some realistic and wise guidelines to our plan for our plans in 2011? The first, I've already noted. The Unitarian Universalists, I think, already are aware of this. Put aside any quest for absolute certainties. There aren't any. And grown-ups need to be reminded of this. The universe is very stingy when it comes to signing contracts and making absolute assurances. Yes, we confidently can count on the steadiness of the laws of physics. Bowling's bathtub theory and its corollary that enough is best are excellent guidelines in planning for the future. And the New Testament admonition, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour of what will pop up in your future." And as I hope I've argued convincingly, we dare not be naive and credulous, believing that we will somehow be singled out amid the unponderable forces that we did not put there. And we won't be offered assurances that we will be shielded from all pain and suffering and loss. That we cannot be assured for. William James writes of the tough-minded, those who learn or lean into life without illusions. And I think that Buddhism offers some even wiser responses to the uncertainty and fearful unpredictability amid which we live. And that response in Buddhism is to honor it, to honor the uncertainty and unpredictability and imponderableness of our future. Buddhist monks have a custom. It's a ritual. They bow in respectfulness to what is given in life. to the ultimately ungraspable mystery of the future. They bow in wordless silence. Then, having acknowledged their own finiteness before the infinite, and having accepted its inscrutable power, they move on to engage life, to engage events, and to deal with unsuspected, surprising events, just as the tough-minded everywhere must do. But that preliminary honoring is vital. It leads them away from what the Greeks called hubris, overweening pride. It transcends the illusions of magical thinking. They acknowledge, the Buddhist monks and Buddhist practitioners do, they acknowledge their connectedness to and reverence for the ungovernable forces of life, and simply accord them the status of the awesome. And before the awesome, they acknowledge that they must be present, simply present, with no need of appeals. Just be open and awake to the mystery. This can foster a calm and confident mindset, which is surely a powerful asset for any new year. Even so, the mandate to develop plans and lay out designs for the future still remains. A corporation with an acquisition and growth plan, a city with a master plan, a couple with a family plan and a financial plan, all are engaging in designs for the future, laying out strategies for our individual and collective future is central to our New Year's business. And it is, as I have tried to indicate, a daunting venture. But in facing this daunting venture of the future, you and I are not alone. We are part of communities, families, religious communities such as this, an international and interconnected web of life which we all share. We can talk to one another. We can comfort one another. We can teach one another. We can plan together and pool our resources. And we have, therefore, this kind of work to do as 2011 opens before us. We earth people have yet to agree, for example, upon wise and humane strategies for the future. The better angels of our nature tell us to find and nurture the lost, and to heal the broken, and to feed the hungry, and to release the prisoner, and to build the community of nations, to bring peace and compassion and love among our brothers and sisters, and to make music in an unafraid heart. How to translate these ideals into jobs with a living wage, available and affordable health services, greater control over our mindless violence, a sensible stewardship of the biosphere. This is surely our challenge on this first Sunday of 2011. Perhaps the best we can do is step into the unknown and surprise-prone future is to follow Robert Frost's marvelous optimism about our potentials for ever-breaking newness, and the courage to be new, which is to say, to open ourselves to moral and emotional growth. And this is the insight of the Buddhist proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And we can begin to see human existence as an ongoing process then of self-fabrication, self-transcendence, community building, so that together we can begin to shape a better future. We may be making only a snail's pace at it, but there are cherries up ahead. And so I wish you a 2011 ever-breaking newness, the courage to grow and to be new. And so may it be. Thank you.
Do we have any comments?
That's very important. Life isn't fair, but we try to make it so. We beleaguered inhabitants of this floating sphere in the universe need to stick together and make things more fair. Welcome. Thank you. You had the phrase limited control, and I did make some points about that. In my house, my wife and kids, and they're grown up, each do their own thing, and I don't have any control over that. But I have a dresser where I keep my clothes, and that dresser top I have absolute control over. Nobody can take that dresser top and do anything with it without my permission. And so limited control, however limited, we can grasp. Yes. And I would go even farther, and hearkening to what the Buddhist said, is to see if we can be able to resonate with what the universe is doing. And that's particularly relevant here on planet Earth. We know that Earth's ecology and system has been damaged by our human actions with climate change and habitat destruction and so forth. And what we can do is cooperate with our earthly home and resonate with its laws. It knows how to protect itself. It's done so for many billions of years. And so cooperation with the little part of the universe in which we live, that cooperation, respect, is something we can do. That's religious in my vocabulary. It's well spoken. The Unitarians and the Universalists merged their two little denominations in 1959, 1960, and as a consequence, we are making our tiny impression upon the universe. The kind of realism with which I have confronted you is intended for grown-ups. This is not the kind of sermon you would give to children. I think they need a little different kind of approach. It's strictly for grown-ups, what I have tried to say. Yes.
I've been struggling to put this thought into a question. I may not succeed, but I'm going to try. Despair is also with us. There's a fine line between perseverance and a fool's errand. Mm. At some point, when things don't work, we have to do something different. Do religions offer us any guidance on where to draw that line?
Yes. You're familiar, it's in the back of your program with the principles of Unitarian Universalism. Each one of us has a moral feeling. We know when we pinch someone else that it hurts. We know that when we starve someone else it is damaging to them. And so we have moral guidelines, and I don't find it a mystery how religion in these terms can be a great benefit and guideline to us. It's not illusory. It's not magical thinking. It is humanistic, humane, compassionate living. To me, this is the heart of Unitarian Universalism, and really the heart of Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, quite apart from all of its doctrine and its traditional belief systems. I think that's what I would want to say. Yeah.